Good afternoon, and welcome to this closing session of the Equinox Summit Learning 2030 from the Waterloo Global Science Initiative. My name is John Matlock, WGSI Management Team Lead, and Director of External Relations and Public Affairs here at Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics. Joining us is Julie Wright, General Manager of the Waterloo Global Science Initiative, and on behalf of the board, it's our pleasure to share this next hour or so with you here on site in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, and online in partnership with TVO.
The Equinox Summit is a creation of the Waterloo Global Science Initiative, a joint venture of the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics and the University of Waterloo. The summit aims to promote dialogue around complex global issues through a combination of public programming and private working sessions, to catalyze the long-range thinking necessary to advance ideas, opportunities, and strategies for a smarter, more prosperous, and sustainable future, and to provide clear outcomes followed by targeted activities around the globe to share the findings.
The first step in sharing outcomes is the focus of today's session and the release of this Equinox communique, a summary of the discussions and a vision for high schools of the 21st century. To do so in this session, there will be two parts: a panel discussion led by our summit moderator, curator, sharing the vision and providing context, and some final thoughts from our WGSI board chair and vice chair. Later, early in the new year, WGSI will release a highly detailed Equinox blueprint. This will provide the concrete steps to move from vision to reality in practical and scalable ways.
At the heart of the summit were three groups of people who collaborated on envisioning the best path forward to reimagine a school for the 21st century. They include experts in the learning sciences, policy, and investment, leaders in system design, education innovators, school leaders and teacher trainers, and young visionaries committed to positive change. To learn more about the people and the process behind the summit, please visit wgsi.org.
We thank all summit participants here today for your insights and collaborations this past week, and we wish to acknowledge everyone here, including many of our special guests from across the political, academic, and business sectors. Thank you for joining us. Now, as you know, our curator is Dr. Michael Brooks. Michael has a PhD in quantum physics, and as a best-selling author, journalist, and broadcaster with wide interests, he keeps abreast of science news and current events that affect our political and cultural life. Michael was instrumental in shaping this entire summit, moderating the daily plenary sessions, and ensuring conversations continued through the day with an open and broad perspective. Now, as we hand off to Michael and the findings, let's revisit where the conversation began just a few days ago.
In the last 12 months, the world has welcomed the birth of 134 million children. Their high school graduation date is 2030. By current estimates, 61 million of them will never get to high school, let alone graduate. Not unless something in education changes, and quickly. Most of us had a factory schooling in an education system designed, conceived, and structured for a different era. Born out of the intellectual culture of the Enlightenment and economic model of the Industrial Revolution, school buildings, the school day, and the educational model used throughout the 20th century were largely based on the principles of factories. Subjects are separated, and children are educated in batches determined by the year of their birth. Bells ring in the same way they did when they were there to teach the future workforce about being punctual and efficient and responding to commands. Although the delivery method has changed, knowledge is still handed down from authority figures while the students sit meekly in their allotted place. Even the school day and the school year were designed for another era, when children had to be let out to work in fields, and when there was always someone at home at 3 p.m. The goal was to transfer knowledge, but it created uniformity and engendered conformity. Though enlightened educators are moving away from this model in a few regions and districts, the movement is fragmented, lacking clear goals, and far too slow. This kind of industrial schooling has created an epidemic of apathy towards learning. By the time they reach high school, as many as 40 to 60% of all students, urban, suburban, and rural, are chronically disengaged from school. For every 10 children who start school, 4 drop out in sub-Saharan Africa, 3 in South and West Asia, 2 in Latin America and the Caribbean. 31 million of the world's children have dropped out of school and may never return. That is a tragic loss to all of us. To miss out on a solid education is to miss out on one of life's most rewarding and satisfying experiences. What's more, every additional year spent in school increases personal income by 10%. Statistics and studies bear out that staying in school is a road to better prospects, a more fulfilling life, and better health. But also because the next generation will be facing a radically different world than the one our educational system is preparing them for. The job market will be drastically different. The last 2 decades have brought us a completely different world, and the next 2 decades will likely create professions, products, services, and opportunities that don't yet exist. Those who make it and graduate in 2030 will need to solve some of the most complex global challenges facing humanity. At the moment, we aren't aligned on how to tackle climate change or deal with shortages of energy, water, and food that are likely to impact on a planet that will be populated by 8.3 billion people in 2030. We will need the full force of this generation's creativity and imagination. It would be calamitous for us to miss out on the next Einstein, Curie, or Mandela. That's why there is an urgency to improve the system, because we are failing to maximize the potential of children currently in the system. We're going to need to be adaptable and flexible moving forward. We need to ask some important questions. How will we give these children the tools to solve big problems and realize new opportunities? What will those tools be? How do we ensure that the children born this year are ready for their life, a life they get to choose in 2030 and beyond? Simply put, how do we take learning into the 21st century?
Ladies and gentlemen, nearly everyone on the globe today has an opinion about education. We know that a caring relationship between student and teacher will be at the center of the successful learning experience, just as it is today. Unfortunately, even our most capable and committed teachers are striving to prepare students for the 21st century while working within an educational model developed for the 19th century. Some believe that system improvement is best managed by tinkering incrementally to achieve the change we desire. The other view is that the structure of school systems is fundamentally outdated and in dire need of a radical transformation. The good news is we know we can do better. In a few places around the world, innovative educators are effecting change and creating the flexible, agile learners the 21st century requires. Over the past 3 days, our summit participants from 6 continents have been collaborating, debating, and prioritizing approaches to education that could, in fact, make a big difference in unlocking the potential of these citizens of 2030. It wasn't easy. We brought together an incredibly diverse group, multinational, multidisciplinary, and multigenerational, to take on this subject. So we are very happy to share with you now the Equinox Communique, a summary of what this group prioritized this week. To do so, we'll examine some focal areas. They are the learner's rights, a new kind of educator, knowing and doing, no more exams, and the learning ecosystem as you have it. We're going to be talking about learners, the roles of teachers, content, learning strategies, learning environment, and the infrastructure. And we'll navigate these topics with these 3 summit participants. Jennifer Groff, co-founder of the Center for Curriculum Redesign. Christine McWebb, director of academic programs at the University of Waterloo's Stratford campus. And Zain Ramahi, co-president of Knowledge Integration at the Student Society, University of Waterloo. After that, we'll turn to comment from John Baker, president and CEO of Desire to Learn, a local technology firm with offices around the world. So, we have these ideas and we have these words in front of us. Jen, learners' rights, can you tell me what that's about?
I'll try. So over the past few days, we looked at many parts of the educational model, and certainly a part of that are the learners, if not the center of that model. So as we explored what role learners must and should be supported in taking in the 2030 model, we ultimately came down to what we believed were rights, as well as roles and dispositions that the learner must or the learner should be able to embody in order to be most successful in such a model. Some of these included something very basic, like the learner has a right to an education, a good education. But they also have a right to safety and feeling safe in their learning environment, things that are fundamental. But we also looked at the fact that the learner needs the right to pursue their intrinsic motivations and define their learning goals. They need the right to have well-being in their environment, and that means physical, mental, and emotional well-being, as well as the freedom to fail, that there's inherent value in feeling safe in failing and trying again. And that is, many of these things are not necessarily present in our current model.
Okay. Can I just ask you, the safety, is that a priority issue, do you think?
Absolutely. Over the past few days, we talked about many different contexts in which such a model might exist and the types of contexts all around the world that have education and learning, which is everywhere, right? So in many of these environments, safety is a key issue, if not the fundamental challenge. And without that, learning just simply can't occur. You just can't engage in a learning experience if you don't feel safe in many levels.
Okay, thank you. We're talking about a new kind of educator. Christine, who is the teacher of 2030? Where do they come from and what do they do? What are they like?
Mm-hmm. I think we can safely say that teachers, or most teachers, get into the profession because they have a passion for learning and because they really, really want to ignite that same kind of passion in the young learner as well. Unfortunately, what we often see in today's highly structured, standardized way of learning in high schools and, of course, at other levels as well, is that after a few years in the system, teachers often try very hard to be innovative. And as we all know, that is not quite so easy, perhaps not as easy as it should be. So the question that we asked in the past 3 days is, how can we remedy the situation, or at least how can we make some beginning recommendations to remedy the situation? And some of the ideas that we have come up with involve the idea of, who is the teacher? So is the teacher just the person who's standing in the front of the room, or is the teacher the community? So can the teacher, so the person who is with the students, leverage the knowledge and the resources of a much, much larger area, that being the physical community that the school is a part of, the local community, but of course also in our world now, the global community through through a technology and other resources that we might have. Another important point, I think, in trying to maintain the passion of the teacher, of the educator, in general terms, is to make sure that teachers are engaged in learning themselves. So we came up with the term of the learning teacher, where the teacher learns together, or the educator learns together with the student, and it's more of a reciprocal relationship on the one hand. On the other hand, to empower educators by giving them new responsibilities. And I know in some areas this is already happening, where the educator actually has part of their responsibility to engage in research, even writing an article, going to conferences on their field, for example, so that the educator becomes a lifelong learner himself, and therefore imparts that kind of a passion in the young learner.
And what kind of training would a teacher have in this kind of scenario?
That's a very big question, and we had a very long discussion about this during the summit. So, of course, as we roll out these recommendations, there will be far-reaching consequences into other areas, such as teacher education. I think a few of the key skills that the new kind of educator, as we call it, would need to have is a large amount of flexibility. And a large amount of flexibility and being able to adapt to a changing environment. I also think that it is very important to be able to effectively peer evaluate with other teachers, as well as reaching out. So one thing that we talked about is that a learner, an educator who realizes, well, there are other resources out there, perhaps I need mentorship.
And teachers could talk to each other wherever they are.
Yes, I mean, we need to be able to take advantage, maximum advantage of the resources that we have. So being networked, I think, is key.
Mm. Of course, we had a relatively short time to discuss all these things, so we'll be able to build on all the kind of foundations that we've built over as we sort of roll out the blueprint phase of this. I wanted to come to you now, Zeynep. We've got this these words up, knowing and doing. Is this about what we're learning?
Absolutely. So we've decided to champion the idea and develop the idea of a T-shaped learner. So at one end of the T, if you visualize the letter T, you have knowing, and on the other end, you have doing. And through a number of habits of mind, six specific habits of mind that we've developed in the communique, those habits of mind would frame and guide and be developed by core competencies that would then form that that narrow point of the T that does focus in on an area of strength. So again, up at the top of the T, you have breadth. We want students who have both breadth and depth. So the breadth means, interdisciplinary work and collaboration, being able to communicate your ideas with experts in other disciplines, but also having themes-based learning that develops the depth and reflects the complexity of our world and our societies in our classrooms. We shouldn't be, simplifying things, because that's not what the world isn't very simple.
And this T-shaped learner model sort of builds flexibility into the student, doesn't it? And the ability to kind of go deep or understand where concepts come from and just deal with things that are thrown at them.
Absolutely, and we don't believe that it really matters where that that T is focused, as long as it's something that the student is passionate about. And you have to give that student some freedom and some flexibility to explore across a wide range of disciplines and to find that thing that they are most passionate about.
Right. Okay. There's probably something on the screen that is troubling a lot of people, Jen. Do you want to explain to us why it says no more exams there?
Sure. We're looking to get rid of exams. assessment is such an integral part of our education systems, no matter where you are. And rightly so, it's an integral part to the learning process. Without assessment, we don't know what's happening in the classroom. We don't know what's happening with the learner. We don't know where they are, what their prior and misconceptions are, and how to build from there. So assessment is key to education. But I think what we've really come to in the last few days is the way that mechanism has gotten distorted over the last several decades in many existing education systems. And so it can't be a driving force in the way that it has been. It needs to be fundamental to the learning process, and that means getting rid of these monolith exams that occur at large points in the year, either once or twice a year, that carry a lot of weight, don't give actually a lot of feedback on the actual learning process that informs that individual learner's needs. So thinking much more broadly about what that means. So when we say no more exams, we don't mean no more ways of measuring learning. We mean getting rid of our current conceptions of assessment and exams and rethinking a model where we have a much broader vision of collecting information about the learner. What does that learner need today? How do I capture that data? And it doesn't necessarily mean A, B, C, or D in numbers. It means about capturing a picture of evidence that they can demonstrate over time that can be used and they can communicate out. Here's my demonstration of what I understand here. Here's how I understand what I need next and how I can show you, be it another peer learner, a future employer, or whatever it might be, their current understanding of their abilities and strengths.
So would you say it's very empowering for the student to know exactly where they are at all times?
Absolutely, and we have lots of evidence of these models. We certainly understand many ways to use assessment. We just don't always do a good job of using these other models. But when a student has that type of understanding and ownership, a lot of these other dynamics that we're advocating for help fall into place.
Okay, thank you. Zeynep, what on earth is the learning ecosystem?
Yeah, so we were given the task of redesigning the education superstructure initially, and immediately we felt that term was inappropriate for a revisioning in 2030. So we decided to see the education as a series of interlocking components, mutually influencing components, and so we decided to go with the education ecosystem. So this is a dynamic system that allows for change and actually supports and encourages evolution. So we're not creating something that in 2031 we're going to have to redesign. We want to create a system that actually supports and encourages innovation and change. So we've decided to call this innovation by design. But the focus of the learning ecosystem, the place where decisions are made that affect learners and learning environments, is going to be students and teachers. So we want a more equitable distribution of power around the table. You know, instead of just having policy school board representatives, we need to bring students and teachers directly into those discussions, not in a consultation perspective, but right at the heart of decision making, to better reflect what goes on in the classroom and who has the power to change a learner's life.
So this is not about some kind of crazy anarchic system. This is about imposing, giving the right people the right amount of control in all the different levels.
And the right supports as well, because we need to understand the importance of policy, and we need to understand the importance of, you know, government benchmarks that will always influence a school system. But we also need to recognize that student and teacher voices are not being well represented at those tables.
Right, okay. Christine, we talked a lot about the school for the 21st century. We moved away from talking about schools for much of our discussion and talked about learning environments because it's not clear, you know, what a school will be, you know, whether it's how it's defined and when it happens and everything else. I was wondering if you could kind of talk a bit to, you know, what these schools might look like.
Mm-hmm. Sure. But before I do that, I actually would like to come back to something that Zeynep said and the idea of inviting the learners to come to the table, I think that the summit itself was a very, very good example of that, because we have high school students and recent graduates and university students among us, Zeynep being one of them, and I think that was a very enriching experience.
It certainly created a different dynamic than has ever, I think, been created in these kinds of discussions, didn't mm-hmm. it?
I'd just add to that, it was in a balanced proportion as well. It wasn't just two students that were brought in, so we were sure that voice was heard. It was
I think
a balance.
There were more students than anyone
there
else.
There might have been.
And they were far more grown up than everyone else.
Great.
As well.
Okay, so going back to the learning environment, an ecosystem, when you think about biology, is organic, right? And anything that's organic changes. And so that is why we chose that term, because what we want to bring across is that the learning space needs to be very, very flexible. And Zeynep mentioned the term innovation by design. I actually have a firsthand experience with this, which is it really does work when you innovate or when you design a space and the kind of activity that then goes on in that space. And I think the Perimeter Institute is a great example of that. So when you walk around the building here, you have areas with a few armchairs and a blackboard. I see a lot of nodding going on here from Neil, which is great. Thank you, Neil. So people are invited to come sit down and have very informal discussions. And so I think the same can be true for a learning space. I think flexibility, again, really, really is the key word. Another key word, I think, is viewing the learning environment as a community hub. So just as I was saying earlier with the educator, that should take full advantage of the resources out there, locally and globally. It's the same for the learning environment and the way a structure, whatever structure that might be, is built will send that message symbolically, I think. So the idea being that ideas and information percolate out of the learning environment, and at the same time, the community is invited in, and a lot of sharing can happen that way. So I think we need more dynamic systems for faster innovation that will be reflected in the learning space. And I'm not suggesting, we talked about safety earlier on, I'm not suggesting that in areas where safety is a concern, that means a very large open space, for example, if that is in any way a danger to the student, but in whatever way that is possible to implement.
Yeah.
If I can also just pick up on that last point, we talked a lot throughout all of our discussions about context dependency. So I think that brings up a good point, you know, if the issue of safety. But there are a number of other issues that in this communique we're not trying to prescribe precisely how things should be done, but the goals and the aspirations of education in 2030. And we recognize that, you know, a different set of resources, different cultures, different communities are going to be implementing this in different ways if they choose to do so.
Yeah. Something that people might be surprised not to see up there is any mention of the T word, technology. Jen, do you want to talk very briefly to what we discussed?
Sure. Let's replace the T word with tools, because that's what technology is. You know, technology became a real sticking point for many of our discussions for lots of reasons, one of which access to such resources. You know, we live in the 21st century where there are many digital technologies in many places, but not everywhere, and it varies across that spectrum. That came down to the point, again, that we're designing learning environments and learning experiences for learners of the 21st century. And so deciding and accessing whatever tools best facilitate that, in large part, come down to the context of the local learning environment. Certainly, 21st century tools are digital tools. Digital literacy is certainly a hot topic in education and a key need for most learners today. But it's about figuring out the right tools that work for your local context and what you have access to with the resources that you have.
Okay, thank you. Christine, just one more question to you. What does all of this cost?
A lot. No, and this, of course, is a very poignant question, and everybody talks about the funding of education, which keeps going up and up and up and up at the expense of other areas such as the health sector, transportation, and that sort of thing. But honestly, I think the opposite is actually true. I think that in a lot of cases, it will be a lot more cost effective. And the reason why I say that is that even though in some of the things that we are proposing, it is true that resources need to be increased. So for example, you may need more personnel in terms of educators, or you may need other resources. But then there is a whole redistribution of resources that goes on. So when we're talking about assessment and exam, which of course costs a lot in the final analysis, just as an example, what falls away there might be redistributed to other costs. So that's one thing. The other thing is that we fortunately live in a world where resource sharing is going on all the time. So that can be done very, very efficiently and quite effectively as well. Not only virtually, so not only when you have access to technology, but otherwise as well. So I think it is more a matter of redistribution than increase in cost.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to invite to join us on stage now, John Baker, President and CEO of Desire to Learn, a local technology firm with offices around the world. John founded Desire to Learn in 1999 at the age of 22 while attending the University of Waterloo. And he saw that online digital tools could open the door to entirely new and more effective models of learning that could be used by students and employees around the world. The company achieves this goal by fine-tuning teaching to each learner's strengths and weaknesses and make the learning experience more personal, adaptive, and accessible. John, you've sort of heard and seen our vision, I hope, for 2030. I wanted to take a moment, really, to consider the shorter term. So this is a space, the education space, that you're working in every day in regions all around the world. Is this future of education, as you see it from here, a partnership between government, our communities, and private companies?
Well, I'd like to applaud you for all the effort that you put in over the last few days and at the summit. We see this as an opportunity for real partnership between companies, between governments, between educators, to really have a transformational impact on the learning experience. And as I travel around the world, whether it's in Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, Europe, everyone's struggling with the same question: how do we really reshape the educational experience for the future? And together, we can start addressing some of those questions. I think there's still a lot of research to be done, But I think we're at the very beginning of a real big transformation in the whole experience that a learner will go through lifelong.
One of the things that really surprised our summit participants was that you say there's a lot of research to be done, but actually many of us sort of discovered through talking to each other that there were a lot of solutions out there that aren't really being shared around the world. Do you find that?
Well, absolutely. So I visited a small school in Australia, and they have 300 different units they offer the students, and they can pick which educational path they want to go down in high school. Wow, that's impressive. Or you go to Singapore, and they're rethinking how workforce development is done to really relink workers that are in the workforce today to being re-educated into the future so that they're always constantly learning and thinking about this as a lifelong journey. Or here at Waterloo, where they've really truly transformed the blended learning experiences that are happening in class, or at Guelph, just down the street, where 80% of the students, you know, that are traditionally on campus and are thought of as on-campus students, but are still taking distance education courses online. So there's all of these pockets of innovation and real good ideas, but there's really no one that's been helping pull these all together in a real common framework or blueprint for really to help educate everyone else that really needs to invest in this infrastructure for the future. Or another great example, you can tell I go all over the world and visit some great clients, is Georgia Gwinnett, where their superintendent no longer talks about building high schools at a physical brick and mortar, but talks about investing in the virtual infrastructure that's going to support a personalized blended experience for their students. So there is great innovation, great ideas, but now we really need to come together to really have an understanding of what really needs to be done for the future.
It's one of the things that we did when we fed back on the things that we had in the summit, that we're going to start talking to each other. it seems like a really sort of fundamental point. And you know, we had people here from six continents, so we're really sort of spread all over the world. And we've established a small network, really, effectively now, starting out. And we're going to start to reach out. But, I mean, do you have any advice to educational professionals who are looking to share or maybe have innovative experiences? What can we do? What can we do to sort of catalyze this process?
Well, I think you're hitting on it when you're zeroing in on the focus on high school in terms of breaking down some of the traditional barriers to access. Being able to really think about what is learning going to be in the future for each learner, and what are their skills, what are the attributes, what are the outcomes that we need to drive for these individual students, and how do we really create an inspiring, personalized environment where, you know, teachers are caring and students are really engaged and able to achieve their full potential. So you can't do that when you're a teacher alone in a classroom. Mm. And so some of our clients here in Ontario, for example, they've created a community where the teachers can share ideas. So if you're teaching science in grade 9, well, what's the best practices? What are the great ideas? What's the inspiration? You know, I'm struggling with this key concept. Students aren't getting it. How do I get help from my colleagues, from not just, you know, in the school, because maybe there's no one else teaching grade 9, but maybe from other colleagues from all around the world. And so how do we build that educational network, that learning network, if you will, is going to be really important for us in the future. And then I think on top of that, we also need to step back as organizations and invest in research and really think about what the questions are for education of the future and make sure that we're making the right investments to support those innovations of the future.
That's right. One of our strong conclusions was that we shouldn't, you know, think that the work is done now. I mean, this is where the work really begins, and we see it as opening up a discussion and opening up avenues for changing, you know, absorbing new research, for instance. So our focus is very much towards starting now. You know, this isn't about what happens in 2030. This is about what we do from here and identifying it straight away. But you're very much in this space. So how do you see the sort of learner experience changing over the next 10 years?
Wow. So over the next 10 years, we're seeing it already in pockets. So if you look at the actual delivery experience, it's going away from face-to-face to a more blended experience where you're leveraging technology as well as the instructor as a coach. I think you've already covered that in your talks. Mm-hmm. You're going to see a lot more online education. So we're already seeing some physical schools melt away into virtual schools. You're going to see those activities becoming very pervasive and turning students from just simply consuming the learning experience to actually producing learning experiences and capturing and sharing their ideas and reflections and leveraging this technology to support not just traditional learning, but also maybe experiential or blended or other types of activities that really can get those students engaged. But you're also going to see textbooks disappear. You're going to see those turn into digital assets. You're going to see them become adaptive. You're going to see different learning pathways being generated automatically for each individual student based upon, you know, where they need to go in the future. But really importantly, it's about building those experiences to be more engaging and more personalized. So instead of the traditional factory model, which was the introduction, you know, it's going to be really one size fits me, not one size fits all. And all of those big trends, those big themes are really going to center around how do we really create an integrated learning experience for those students that gives them a whole range of different pathways for the future, but doesn't dictate this is the one you're going to go down and doesn't get them trapped or into a dead end, but allows them to have that foundation so they can jump from one idea to the next. So, you know, as I went to university, I thought I was going to be a doctor, but, you know, I wound up being an engineer and then running a company. So, you know, being able to give the kids and the next generation of learners that foundation so they can go out there and conquer the problems of the world is really important.
Okay, Christine, you wanted to come in on that.
Yeah, this, of course, presupposes access to technology, right? I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on how these massive changes, which I totally agree with you, will come, I think. How will that play out in geographical regions where perhaps access to technology is not quite as widespread as it is here or in other parts of the world?
Yeah, so I think the access to technology is still a really big factor. You know, just over a billion people have access to great technology today, but there's still you know, billions more. I think the stat was over 8 billion shortly. You know, we have a big problem in terms of investing in that infrastructure to support equal access for this type of learning experience for everyone around the globe. But, you know, by educating the students that can have this technology and giving them the best experience, then they hopefully can go off and help solve some of these other problems around, you know, providing more access or breaking down some more of these barriers. If I just rewind the clock to me starting off, you know, if you were blind, you couldn't access learning as effectively as anyone that was sighted. Well, that's no longer true today. You can access any course from any program anywhere in the world that's leveraging this type of technology equally with everybody else. So give entrepreneurs and give organizations a chance to go break down some of those barriers and they'll rise to the occasion. You just have to give them the investment and the drive to do so.
Okay. Welcome to our summit, by the way. Clearly, the discussion continues. We opened our summit with Gallup Education's Brandon Busteed, and he talked about the teachers who care, and this very much became central to the discussions that we had. And the thing that was universally acknowledged was that we all had teachers who cared, and we all knew teachers currently working today. You know, the vast majority really care about what they're doing. They're passionate about what they're doing. You know, we're not talking about any kind of lack of care. We're talking about hampered ability, if you like. I was wondering if you could talk to whether technology can enhance this sort of teacher-learner relationship.
So I really like that idea of caring. I think it's one of the key ingredients that makes a great teacher. Just like everything else, there's many ingredients. They've got to be inspirational, they've got to care, they've got to certainly understand the subject that they're teaching. Really engaging those students is going to be the driver, and caring is certainly a big part of that. If I look at my parents, who are educators, that taught in the traditional classroom for a long time and now teach online, they find that they actually, you know, in the classroom, were only able to reach and care for a certain group of the students that really engaged or really wanted to dive deep into the topic. But online, they're actually able to build a personal relationship with absolutely every student in the class because they're providing, you know, direct feedback, they're having dialogue, they're having discussions, and they actually find the experience as good or better than what they had in the traditional classroom. So yes, you can build those caring relationships. You can break down barriers to access. And you can deliver a great educational experience with or without technology.
There are certain types of course, though, that don't lead to any kind of relationship. I'm thinking in terms of the MOOCs. You know, sort of, once things get to a certain scale, you know, we kind of apply technology, and then you do lose that personal element, don't you?
Well, yeah, I think today's MOOCs are more broadcast model, kind of like when we used to do learning through TV. Or traditional textbook. And I think if we were to look at what makes online learning successful, it's when you can build those relationships, engage with a caring peer that inspires you or a teacher that inspires you. And the more that we can make this learning experience more personal, the better. I think people forget when building these MOOCs today is the role of the teacher, the role of the parent, role of the other stakeholders in the educational journey. And the more that we can get them engaged, the better. It's not about less teachers, it's about more teachers. Mm. It's about giving them the tools to really engage those students and help them achieve their full potential, not give them sort of the lowest common denominator educational experience. Okay.
Another aspect of the discussions that we had was about how there are many societies in which education and every provision within society is very much a collectivist, it belongs to the community kind of thing. I mean, do you think digital technologies encourage a more individualistic approach to education?
I think educators want to provide a more individualized approach to education for their students, and personalized, I think, is the other really key, and differentiation, all three of those. And technology helps lend itself so that, if I was to give you a personalized learning plan that reacted to every movement you made in the class, it would be tough for me to scale as an instructor. I could probably do that if I had one student, possibly two, if I was really good. But I can't do it for 30 in a traditional high school. So if we can leverage technology to create those pathways and adapt automatically and understand where the student is struggling and maybe even predict where they might be going in the future and really get them on the right track, then all of a sudden we're giving the tools to the teachers to enable them to really help each student reach their full potential.
Okay, I was kind of reaching towards a space where, can you see technology as impacting communities rather than individuals?
Yeah, absolutely. A good example in Brazil, I noticed there's some people from Brazil here. President Dilma leveraged online education and learning that was proven as through a partnership with Canada to lift 1,000 women out of poverty. So they looked at a community problem like poverty, where these women didn't finish elementary school, they didn't finish high school, but through education helped them accelerate that path. Now they have jobs, they've transformed not only their lives, but they've also now transformed their lives with their family and their next generation. So yes, education has a huge role in not only improving the education sector, but also in terms of transforming society, transforming communities, and transforming other industries. Mm-hmm. And I think we're at the very beginning of understanding how education can really have that impact.
Okay. Zainab, I was wondering if I can bring you in just to talk about the kind of importance to the learner of a kind of good support network. Is that a vital part of being a learner, is being part of something bigger?
Absolutely. Bringing it back to that issue of being rooted in the community, I think is very, very important. And that's how we can, I talked about translating, passion and knowledge into action. So that's one of the frames or one of the habits of mind that we envision. And I don't think it's until a student feels that they have a voice and that they have leverage and that they have influence in their respective communities, whether that's personal, whether that's on an individual level, on a local level, or on a global level, until they feel like they're connected to that, until we, ensure that they have those voices or stop preventing them from speaking, they'll be motivated to create change.
So it's a kind of a redressing of the balance of power.
Absolutely.
Yeah. John, if I can ask you, and we talked a little bit about partnership between government, communities, and private companies. Can we come back to that and just give me a sense of how you see the kind of the distribution of power, as it were, between those three? Who's kind of leading this?
Well, my hope is that at the center of it is the learner, and then obviously parents and teachers and other stakeholders that are in making sure that they've got the best educational experiences. But who has the power? I think the better question is like, what's the alignment of values and what's the alignment of the goals and objectives for those organizations working together? So if I look at when we state here's what we're trying to do as a company, we say it's about improving the enrollment, it's improving the graduation outcomes, it's improving retention rates, improving graduation rates, and that's what we focus on when we build our technology and support our clients. But in other cases, if you're just simply there to maximize the shareholder returns, and it's completely just one the old way of thinking about the bottom line, you're really not building a real partnership. And so, I think we've got to balance providing the highest quality educational experience and the best possible outcomes with making sure that we've got a healthy partnership with governments and with companies.
And would you see the role of setting certain things like curriculum, say, as government responsibility?
I think the responsibility, again, I think is a shared responsibility. I think we all have a role in helping to guide and to direct where the curriculum should go in the future. We shouldn't just leave that to government to make that decision.
The reason I push it is that part of our discussions was that this idea of who sets or decides what things should be learned is a different matter to who decides how those things should be pursued. What kind of methods do you use in a classroom or a learning environment in order to have the learners build their capabilities? And these are difficult questions, aren't they?
Well, it's a huge question because if you look at how much knowledge there is being generated in the world today compared to 100 years ago, the pace is picking up. We don't have to educate the people today with the exact same knowledge as 100 years ago. That's doing them a disservice. They need to really learn a lot more. So the whole exercise of what's in the curriculum and what's not in the curriculum is really important. But more importantly, how do we help them accelerate their learning? Because the pace is not slowing down, it's picking up. And we really need to think about new and creative ways to really engage them. And then, I also think there's a role for researchers here, which can look into the future and say, here are the jobs for the future, here are the skill sets, here are the competencies, here are the outcomes, here's the characteristics, here's the vision for the future, and how do we map that back to the foundation we're providing to high school students or elementary school students? Mm-hmm. So if critical thinking, which I believe is really important for the future, is really foundational, well, how do we improve the curriculum to support that? But that should be research-based. I don't think that should be just us sitting on a panel and just going, well, I think it's this.
Jen, go on, jump in.
So I want to unpack some of the language you used, which was who sets the curriculum. And I think much of the work of this past week was looking at frames that we approach this work with. And I think part of the challenge, the reason that we are where we are in education is, so inert and so static, is that we think of things like setting the curriculum. And we don't want to set content and curriculum was one of the themes for our work. And one of the things we didn't want to happen was to say, here's our take on it, let's revisit it in 2031. Yeah. That would be dangerous, right? So how do we collectively, globally, and using people like researchers, learning scientists, to influence the general curricular structure, and then always be working locally to be pushing and pulling on what we value in setting that curriculum and making it a living document rather than something that defines our whole system?
That's your problem with assessment as well, where assessment traditionally in education has been, we look at a study over 5 years and see what the impact was. Well, I did systems design engineering at Waterloo, and if you don't have a good feedback system, you don't have a good system.
Right.
And so that needs to be real time, maybe even predictive, and really be able to drive for faster change. So absolutely agree with you.
That's right. We certainly heard a lot about the fact that you can use and harness technology in order to have these rapid feedback systems that will really change the way you can interact with the learner and the learning professional, and you can just be constantly assessing and valuing if you have access, of course, to those systems. Christine, speak to this is notion of partnership. I mean, this is the future, isn't it? There's the the public-private partnership, the roles of government and private and community. This is a complex space, isn't it?
It's a very complex space, but it's not an unmanageable space, I don't think. Okay. And I think it's a very welcome space. so, for example, as a university professor talking to John, who has lots of industry background, I mean, I just think that we can really learn a lot from each other. I think that this whole idea of a set curriculum, a lot of it really comes down to the notion of disciplines, right? So, I mean, maybe that's also a starting point. Do we really need the notion of these separated, segmented, isolated disciplines? Well, you can probably guess that the answer that we had discussed is no.
We're seeing the end of trigonometry, aren't we?
Not necessarily, but no. But no, that's not it. And we said that, certain skills do need to be taught. But the question is, in what configuration do you teach them? So one of the recommendations that we were discussing was that perhaps the teaching should be more problem-based or theme-based even. And that also addresses this idea of setting the curriculum. So as themes or complex problems change, as they will in a moving society, the so-called curriculum also needs to change, right? So it just needs to be a much more adaptive situation. And the only way you can guarantee that is through dialogue with industry and through dialogue with government.
Right.
And just to ground perhaps this discussion a little bit more for those, you know, who might be concerned, well, then what is it that we need to convey? We did develop, like I referenced earlier, habits of mind. So I can go through, you know, several to give you an example. So the freedom to fail that I think Jen was talking about, and recognizing that failure is a step towards success and a step towards innovation. Metacognition, understanding what you do know and understanding what you have yet to learn. These are things that learners of 2030, 2060, 2090 are going to need to be equipped with. Being mindful of and being present in individual, local, and global contexts, as I alluded to before. You know, having a good understanding of what your local community affords you and how it limits you and how you're connected to it and the opportunities that exist within it, and also recognizing that you're part of an increasingly globalized system. So these are all, these are what we chose to call habits of mind, but they're applicable across all contexts, and that's why we included them.
Okay. So now let me stay with you for a moment. I just wanted to ask you, as one of the younger people in the room, did you leave it thinking, do you know what, this could work out well? You're quite optimistic.
I'm extraordinarily optimistic, and I approach that from two different perspectives. One is a great need. I recognize that there is a great, great need to produce students in a way that we haven't been doing thus far. We have incredibly complex global issues, and we're not preparing students by and large to face those, and so we really, really need to do that. And the second is, you know, it's already being done in so many small pockets, as John talked about, as other people have discussed. It's being done, it's being shown, you know, it's shown that these initiatives have had great success already. So I don't see why, I think it's important that we need to maintain our energy level coming out of this. Remember what we're trying to do and what we're trying to build and the scope, the magnitude of what we're trying to build. And that should lead us forward in carrying this out in our respective places around the world.
Okay. John, do you think there needs to be an acceleration of the pace of change? Change is happening.
Yes.
But is it happening fast enough?
I've not seen more willingness to change than I have in the last couple of years. I've been doing this for about 14 years since I was in university, and the pace is certainly picking up, and the willingness to at least look at the possibility for change. But we're really at the very, very, very beginning of a sea of change that's going to happen. So if I look at Canada, Canada's getting further and further ahead on the concept of blended learning, but if I look at the U.S., less than 5% of schools have access to any type of blended or online experience. We have to accelerate the change because the shift in society, the changing pace of new knowledge being created, and the new jobs that are being set up, we're not giving the kids the foundation that they're going to need for the future. You go visit any large company that's got great engineers or great scientists, and they'll talk about how they need to have their scientists and engineers re-educated now, because things have changed so much in the last 10 years.
Tell me more about that. What kind of skills are they looking for now?
Well, a great example is when I was in university, we were taught software development life cycle and how to waterfall cycle, and now it's all agile, and we have a whole new methodology for tackling problems. We used to be comfortable with a monthly, rhythm to meetings. Well, that's no longer the case. It's stand-up scrums every single day to really try to figure out how do we tackle the problems of the day and really keep ourselves very, very agile in terms of adapting to the different environmental factors. Yet still, we really need to be able to have the skill sets to put together the big picture, take A and B and figure out what C is going to look like because, that's very rare in today's day and age. To really have the cognitive skills, the ability to synthesize new knowledge, the ability to do the research that's going to be required to really support putting us in the right direction. So yes, we have to accelerate, and we have to do it now, or else we're going to be setting ourselves up for a competitive disadvantage in the very near future.
Right, so it's not about having a grade at a certain level getting you a job anymore. Employers are actively looking for something beyond that.
Completely different. It's no longer about being able to just simply problem solve. It's now knowing how to find the right problem to solve. Mm. It's no longer about just taking a task and repeating it. It's now trying to figure out, well, that task is broken and I need to figure out how to fix it with a new methodology, and then I need to be able to articulate that very succinctly to a large array of people. All these new skills are coming into play that the traditional approach to providing the education needs to continue to shift and evolve.
Jen, is this why we're in this position where, you know, saying no more exams is something of a slogan, but you know, because they're not doing the job that everybody thought they would do?
In many systems, they take up so much space. And so if you remove them, you free up so much more time for learning, for deep learning, for producing T-type learners that Zainab talked about and you just demonstrated. That was an example of a T-type learner who has depth in a profession but has the breadth to put it together and the skills that reside above that to piecemeal the resources and tools and people they need to go problem solve the problem they have.
Yeah.
Well, it's also a shift from an accountability system built on an examination to an accountability system based upon outcomes. And now just rethinking how we demonstrate those outcomes. So if you've got public speaking skills, well, how do you demonstrate that? Is that an exam you write, you know, while you're in a big theater? Probably not. It's probably gonna be like, here's my portfolio of my work and here's a couple of videos of me doing a presentation. So we really need to think about better ways of doing assessment and moving towards more of a strong foundation versus an exam, typically you pass or fail. Whereas if you don't understand fractions, you're never going to work at the Perimeter Institute. and so we can't leave that one little piece of your educational journey out. We need to make sure that we understand where the strengths are and what outcomes you need to have and what that pathway is going to look like.
All right. Christina, let me just ask you this. As somebody who works in the higher education sector, many people, certainly for me in the UK, you know, you get your A-levels and you get your grades and you go to university and the university assesses you, or you think it assesses you on grades. Are universities not really assessing? They're interviewing, they're sifting, and are grades an issue?
I wish I could
say. Or would
say
a lack of grades be an issue?
I can only talk to the situation that I'm in Ontario as far as systems are concerned. I wish I could say that they are not only assessing on grades, but unfortunately, I think in 90% of the cases, it's only on grades right now. So that's what I think we said earlier, is that this kind of a massive change in the education system for high school, it's going to have ramifications in other areas. I think that grades are, as I think most people would agree, in some level arbitrary, because they're mostly numerical, and exam-based testing is, you know, you have one shot at it, and if you don't feel well on that day, for example, well, rough luck. So it's a little bit arbitrary in a sense. Unfortunately, the kind of mass education world that we live in now makes any other form of admission criteria, let's say, quite difficult to implement with the resources we have. I mean, that's just the reality, right?
But it's doable.
Yeah, I think so.
Zainab, we're just going to go to audience questions in a moment, but I'll leave you with the last word. You want to make a point. I wanted to ask you a question as well, which is, do you think this will kind of democratize access to higher education and things beyond? Yeah, will this help the students who don't like exams, don't do well in exams, to actually sort of fulfill their potential much, much better?
Yeah, I think the issue of equity came up every day in every session during our deliberations, but I don't know if the point of our education system is necessarily to prepare people for post-secondary education. I think it's to prepare them to tackle the challenges that they're going to be facing. If the next natural step for them is to enter the post-secondary world, I can tell you from a personal perspective, and this is what I was actually going to draw on, I was a relatively high achiever in high school. It didn't matter. I was surrounded by others who were relatively high achievers in high school once I got to university, but the way that our academic paths have changed or have differed from each other has been framed by our ability to cope with ambiguity and with failure, you know, being flexible. It had nothing to do with what grades we got in high school. So we're trying to prepare people with a broad range of skills, stuff that, you know, all of us have talked about, I think, to be able to face whatever challenges and different, this is a communique that is going out to the globe, right? This is for a global context.
Okay, thank you. I have to say that I was left with an enormous amount of optimism, largely as a result of some of the younger people in the room were basically outshining most of the rest of us. sort of optimism and shame at the same time, the fact that I seem to have wasted the first 30 years of my life. We're going to move to a period of audience questions now. So I'd really invite, certainly to start with the members of our summit participants. If you have questions for the panel, please come over and use the microphone here on the right. Sorry. And here's one of them. One of the great things about our summit was the representation. It was so diverse and extraordinary. And thanks, Lenny. We'll take your question now.
Are you only saying that because I'm Aboriginal?
No, I'm saying I'm looking through the whole lot of them. This is what I had to put up with for the whole of the last 4 days. I would always say, I was the one who had to say the wrong thing so that everybody else could say the right thing.
Hey, in my high school, like, we had a, like, my, I didn't go to a traditional high school. Like, my high school was really different from what normal students would actually go through. Like, my high school incorporated traditional values and traditional Aboriginal beliefs. So I actually have two questions. Mm. How much adaptation, I just kind of want clarification for everyone else on how much adaptation there would be for, like, the really down-to-earth local context. And I just wanted to bring up an example of how we were graded in one of my business classes, in which we would do a Dragon's Den style business plan presentation on my business course. And we were, like, assessed on how well we did for our presentations and how well we knew our own business through the business plan that we, or through the, our own business plan projects that we built up from our own ideas and from our own perspectives. And like, this, how well we did was translated into a grade. So I was wondering if you believe that would be, I guess, a good hybrid system, or if we should switch to a hybrid system while we move to this no exam situation.
Okay, let me ask Jen that first thing, as you spoke to exams.
So the example you've just given is an alternative form of assessment. I would question the value of translating it to a grade. I'm guessing you had to, given that's what your system used. But it's a great example of where the actual context pulled out all sorts of nuances and the skills you needed to be evaluated on, to get feedback for yourself on how to improve, and to demonstrate what you're strong at and what you need improvement on. It's how we document that that would imply a new type of assessment rather than just giving you a grade.
Zainab, would you agree?
I would agree. And I think the first point that you spoke to about adaptability, so it's important to remember that we will be localizing everything that is in the communique, but we're also preparing people that will be interacting with those who are not in their local context. And so I think that's, you know, one of the underlying threads throughout the entire process.
Christine, does a hybrid system work for you while we make these sort of transitions?
I actually think that's a really, really good idea. It's always better to move towards a new goal in steps rather than very, very abruptly. Mm-hmm. Just a point to the first part of your question. I think it is very desirable to cater to local conditions, because local conditions will vary greatly. I mean, the local conditions of southwestern Ontario are not the local conditions of Uganda, because we have a representative here from Uganda, and we talked about that quite a bit. And a lot of what might be talked about in schools here is just simply irrelevant, right? So I think it's absolutely desirable to cater to the local conditions.
Thank you.
Let's have our next question.
I think what you've just been touching on and what I've been most impressed with is the seemingly flexible and adaptable nature of what you've produced. And I'm wondering, I know this conference was centered around high school, but was there discussion that went into, you know, how does this even, I mean, it's something that looks like it would work in elementary school and in post-secondary school. So I'm just wondering if those kind of discussions happened and what kind of ideas you had about even moving this model beyond the context of the conference.
Zainab, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that was at the forefront of my mind, and that was maybe an assumption that all of us questioned, I think, on one of the first days. It was, are we talking about a system of education with interrelated parts, or are we talking only about a high school? And also, I mean, what does even high school mean in certain places? Somebody mentioned that for them, secondary school started at age 11. For me, it was, you know, age, whatever, 13, 14, 15. So we have to, I think it's most helpful to think from a systems perspective. And I absolutely agree that the things that we have come up with here are applicable at all levels.
I mean, it's certainly a starting point, isn't it, Jen?
Yeah.
I'm speaking for myself here, but one of the things that inspires me most about the notion of the blueprint and ultimately what will come to be is it also not only inspires and then guides potentially, but it acts as a tool through which you can do this adaptation. And to Lenny's question about, you know, integrating in local content and curriculum, same ideal. So it serves as a mechanism by which you can facilitate these discussions in your local community of stakeholders.
Okay.
Hi there. Being on the being involved in all this, but also following Twitter a lot, there's a lot of parents out there asking what role they have in this new system, and I wondered if the panel would like to open up that discussion.
I can speak to that in terms of our going back to that education ecosystem I was introducing mm-hmm. before, and the summits that we have planned. We have parent representatives at the table, and so for us, we absolutely recognize the power of parents and the interest level of parents in their child's education, and we don't think it would be helpful to exclude them from those decision-making conversations.
And in fact, as assessment models expand, it invites parents into that conversation more easily because they can make sense of the various sorts of evidence that you can use to interact with the student and the parent as well.
And I think if you look, I did a great course here called Epistemology of Systems Thinking and actually looked at the educational system and the actors within it. And what's amazing is people forget that the parent is the second most important actor in the system, not the teacher. And so if you draw concentric circles, it's the learner at the center, then the parent, then the teacher, then the school, and it keeps on going up to the government. But if you think about it, most other countries, the parent is heavily involved throughout the entire educational journey, giving them extra tutoring, extra help, extra advice. I don't know if they help them on certain activities or not, but they certainly are heavily involved in the whole educational experience. In North America, we tend to like give that over to the school system to take on that responsibility. I think there's a need for us to rethink that as we look at trying to build a more competitive economy. So it's interesting. I think parents are often forgotten, and I think they play an incredibly important role.
So we're glad they're asking on Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely. Linda.
Okay, so I'd first like to congratulate all the summit participants on what I think is a really, truly groundbreaking, truly forward-thinking breath of fresh air into our education system. However, I would like to ask the panel, in terms of implementation, I know, of course, that is the biggest question, but particularly in countries where conformity is valued widely in the culture and in the education system and bureaucracy in particular, how do you think we can counter really long-held assumptions which are held not only within the education system but in society generally?
I think that Lenny actually gave us the answer to that in with his previous question, in that any kind of a change will not come about abruptly but in transitions. I think that's the first item, and the other one is the kind of local relevance that we were talking about. I mean, the blueprint is not something to be taken as a recipe, right? So I mean, it needs to be adapted to local circumstances and be implemented in as much as that is desired and possible, I would say.
Jen?
I think it also, we need to think about the context where that's the case. We've had many voices at the table talking about how this model might fit in various contexts. This challenge is true not only for those cultures and societies where it's pretty explicit that this is the case, and those where it's less explicit, like the United States, where I'm from. So I can imagine many schools that value student voice and say that they believe in these sorts of models, but when it comes down to it, it's not necessarily what we have in our system, and we are reluctant to give into those changes that might afford them that independence. So I think part of the challenge is framing this document in a way that makes sense for each context, and that was one of the suggestions for the final blueprint.
But I also think there's just to add another dimension to that. I think you're alluding to, you know, the learner's own desires, their own passion for what they want to learn and where they want to go. And I think we also have to remember that while these are going to be implemented locally, there's still a new concept around global access to whatever knowledge, whatever learning you want to achieve. And so the learner themselves and the parents and other stakeholders in the system can really think about things in a new way and not just think about just the local context.
Okay.
Hi. I was wondering, you've discussed a little bit of the getting the governments involved in changing the education system, but I was wondering if you could discuss a little bit the idea between private and public education. Like, in some countries, we really value the public education in the way that we don't believe that you need private schools. So have you, what do you think of it? Have you considered, like, does it create perhaps more inequality if this sort of education would be only implemented in private schools, or does it make a difference?
Nobody wants to take that one. I'm going to force you, John. I'm sorry.
Oh, this is a tough one. We have clients on both sides of the fence on this one. We have clients that are private that are trying to build the best possible quality educational experience. We have public educational institutions that are trying to do the same. It really falls down to an equality of access question. You know, what is your society or what does your country value? And if it's being able to break down some of those social barriers, if you will, in terms of mobility, then there really needs to be a well-funded public or a well-funded public-private system to really support an equal access to opportunity. And you know, even Warren Buffett, who's probably one of the best capitalists in the world, will highlight the fact that the public education system is really the only thing that's left that's enabling that social mobility. Mm-hmm.
And nobody has any comments.
I'll add. I mean, equity is always a concern in education, no matter what models we've stuck or we've stayed with or where we're moving to. So it's something we always need and should be mindful of. I think what is interesting about technology is it can begin to open things for individuals. So I know this has been a big movement in education over the last 5 to 10 years of putting a lot of content online, of creating free and open access to quality resources. And I think we're just at the beginning of that. Certainly just putting content online doesn't equal a deep and quality education, but it's the start. And I think more tools will come along to leverage that and make it more open and accessible no matter where you are.
So I was just wondering whether you see this as kind of mirroring things that are happening, say, in healthcare. I mean, are we going in the same direction?
I think you're going to have similar debates. And if I look at some of our private high schools, for example, that are providing education, we got both ends of the spectrum. We've got ones that are like lower quality in terms of the experience, but we also have some that are just absolutely amazing and probably the highest quality we've ever seen anywhere in the world. So you're going to have a spectrum of quality and the educational experience, you know, and then the question becomes, you know, if you've got one public education system that's doing an amazing job, there probably won't be room for private. But the privates tend to come in and fit into the niches where the public is not necessarily filling the requirements for the market. And so it's, you know, there's going to be a balance. There's no question that that seems to be where most of the world is going. And then the question becomes, well, what accountability, what metrics do you put on these institutions to really make sure that they're living up to the standards that you want to see produced?
Okay. Christine, let me just pull back to you. And you know, we talked earlier about the cost of the kinds of things that we were recommending. Let me reiterate, we're not sort of talking about something that's going to require massive investment and then we hope to recoup it. I mean, do you see this very much as something that's doable without injection of extra money?
I really do think so. I mean, and again, it does bring us back a little bit to the question of technology, because technology in the sense will be a huge enabler. If we have certain technologies available to us, I mean, they just simply will make things cheaper, right? Mm. So that's kind of how I see it. I think as long as you follow a model of resource sharing, be that, like I said, physical or virtually, I think that cost effectiveness will certainly be there.
Okay. Mm. Well, as I said, we're very much at the start of this journey, and it has been quite a journey. Mm. But I think there's a very exciting future ahead of us, and there were people in the room who'd, for instance, had children recently enough that they kind of got excited about the fact that 2030 education, 2030 learning really might be quite different for their children. And it's certainly our hope that this is something that really starts to kick in much sooner than that, isn't it? So as we close this panel discussion, I'd just really like you to take a moment to thank John Baker, Jen Groff, Zainab Rahmi, and Christine McWebb. The brain has finally given out. So thank you very much for joining us.
And thank you, Michael, for a wonderful job curating all week and all the work that went into summit for the past year. Thank you to all the participants here today, and I just want to let everybody know online that the communique that we've been discussing here today is becoming available shortly at wgsi.org, so please come online for the complete communique.
And now, in closing the Equinox Summit, please welcome back the chair of the Waterloo Global Science Initiative and director of Perimeter Institute, Dr. Neil Turok, along with WGSI Vice Chair and the President and Vice Chancellor of the University of Waterloo, Dr. Faridun Hamdulipur.
Thanks very much. It's been an amazing week. I didn't understand how you could possibly tackle such a difficult series of questions in such a short time and emerge with a consensus. It's really quite amazing, which is both radical and pragmatic. And I wanted to say something which sort of struck me during this week, which is, you know, why are we holding a summit on the future of education in a theoretical physics institute? and there's actually a very simple reason. You know, theoretical physics is really about the universe, and it's about understanding the universe and just contemplating the universe and the power of the human mind to comprehend it and to utilize it is a very humbling thing. And I think you walk through the doors of Perimeter Institute, and we do too, I mean, all the people who work here, and to realize this is a place dedicated to improving our understanding of the universe and improving the state of the world through that understanding. It's humbling to all of us. And everyone who walks through the doors at Perimeter, I think we're encouraged to leave our ideological baggage behind. And so it turns out that this is an ideal venue for contemplating the future, for collaborating on new ways at looking at the future, to leave behind the mechanical views of reality many of us have, be it political, ideological, or whatever. And that's really what's characterized this summit, is people from such diverse backgrounds. One participant described it after the first day. He said it's like bringing representatives of 50 religions together and asking them to design one. and it did feel a bit like that on the first day. But on the second day, that went away. And I think right now there's an amazing degree of convergence around interesting new conception for what education should be. So it's been a massive pleasure to host this. We're totally committed to supporting you in the future. We do not want this to end after this event. We're not really a conference holding place. We're a place where ideas emerge which change the future. And that's what we want to ensure happens. So thank you.
Let me, on behalf of the board of WGSI, our colleagues at the Perimeter and at the University of Waterloo, thank you all for participating in this very important exercise. As I was listening to the panel, I didn't know why I was having this little anxiety in me. Then I figured out that how are we going to design an admission system that is not based on high school average? Then my anxiety started subsiding because first thought was, by year 2030 or 31, I will have been retired in sailing. So I didn't have to worry about it as university president. And second thought was, this is exactly what we expected from this summit, that it will jolt us out of our comfort zone, and it will push us in a direction that we will be very innovative. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so proud of that the two institutions, the Perimeter Institute and the University of Waterloo, that we were able to put this event together, this summit together. We pride ourselves, we're being at the forefront of innovation, and this is one of the examples. At the beginning of the summit on Sunday, we pointed out that the world is going to be different. No doubt about it, there will be many new challenges, different opportunities, and we called it the mere tinkering of our education system, secondary education system, will not be enough to really maximize the potential of our students, new students, to understand and tackle those issues and challenges. We needed a system-wide earthquake, and this is the kind of jolt we needed. Is our current system really that bad? Not at all. I wouldn't even call it like that. After all, both Neil and myself and many others in this room are the product of that system. But this system is going to have to change because it just simply won't be enough to prepare the kind of graduates we want. So, as Michael, you pointed out, it doesn't end here, it starts here. As you will see anywhere, everywhere in the city and at the university, that it says ideas start here. Yes, ideas started here, and we're going to ensure that this is a marathon. The marathon just started here. There are various marathons in this field, but this is a very special marathon. I think I wouldn't even call it a marathon. This is a triathlon. Then we are running and swimming with our bicycles. This is the kind of triathlon. This is the kind of marathon we're going to run. How are we going to do this? How do we know how to run, how to swim? I think the hope is that the blueprint is going to tell us. The blueprint will help us to start this journey. And I'm so excited that the summit started us thinking in that direction. Again, let me thank you for being here. Let me thank you for your contributions. And let me thank you for attacking this, what many people will call a taboo subject. Thanks very much.
As Ferdin mentioned, the work accomplished here this week doesn't end as we leave the theater today. The Waterloo Global Science Initiative will be working, as Michael Brooks also mentioned, to further develop today's findings into the Equinox Blueprint. So I do have a job after today. The Blueprint will be distributed globally in early 2014, and WGSI representatives will engage with international leaders and communities at events with media in the year ahead. And our Forum of Young Leaders will now have the opportunity to take part in the Equinox Fellowship. And this is a program that provides guidance, mentorship, project development and management skills so that they can get some sort of education-related initiative that is close to their hearts, as well as some seed funding to help launch that project. WGSI.org remains a living website with all the videos and other content from the summit, so we encourage you to go back and have a look at what we did this week. Site also hosts an online mapping project that tracks progress made against the priorities set out in the Equinox Blueprint. We will now begin following the progress against our Learning 2030 goals once we get the blueprint launched in the new year, but to date we've already mapped a lot of information that relates to our Energy 2030 Summit from June 2011.
Now, in concluding this summit communique event on behalf of the WGSI management team, please allow us to thank the WGSI board, which also includes Dr. Arthur Carty, Dr. Tom Brastowski, and Michael Duchenne. Thank you. The visionaries behind WGSI so many years ago, including Dr. Cal Stiller, Ken Knox, and David Bogart. Our Equinox facilitator, Dan Normando, our summit rapporteur, Bob Holmes, the WGSI team and volunteers, the entire staff of Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, and our many, many partners at the University of Waterloo. Also to TVO's Lisa DeWild and the entire team behind the cameras and behind the agenda here on site all week long in Waterloo. Thank you, TVO, for your support in bringing these summit activities to the wider world and on television and online. And finally, to Sean Kiley and Frank Taylor of Tidal Entertainment, as well as Mark Patterson and Kevin Gooby of Eclipse Productions, our rock-solid special event partners.
For those of you on site, please join us for a reception just outside on the main level. And for those of you online, we hope you continue to explore all the content from earlier this week, and also to follow along on the Learning 2030 activities that will continue on the agenda on TVO. Thank you all from this Equinox Summit Learning 2030.